This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, where we discuss all the books and comics from the Star Trek universe. I'm just one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and joining me, as he does every week, whether we want him to or not, I'm just kidding, we want him to. We love him. He's Bruce Gibson. Bruce, how's it going today?
No. That's all. That's it. I'm out of here. I can tell when I'm not wanted. I'll just pack up my Star Trek books and my comics and head out. That's all good.
There's no way I can do this alone, dude.
Me either. We need each other.
Awesome.
And we're going to do something new this time in the future, something a little different, right?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
So we had a call with our patrons of Patreon. We did a roundtable for July, and it was about Star Trek books and comics. And one of the things we asked them is about spoilers. Because, you know, when we do the features, we go like right into the book as if everybody's read it. We approached it this time. We're going to go into this with a spoiler-free part. When you go into the feature, it'll be spoiler-free for however long. But then we'll give you a notice that we're going into spoilers. So if you haven't read the book and you want to know a little bit about it, you'll get to hear some things up front before we get into the spoilers. So it gives you a little more opportunity to decide if it's something you want to read or just learn about some things about the book before you dive in. Then you can come back later and listen to the spoilers.
Definitely. Yeah. And so that was one of the suggestions from the Patreon roundtable. Thanks you guys for sharing your opinions about that. I'm glad we can, you know, make the podcast a little bit more accessible, a little bit more meaningful to everyone, not just people who are always keeping up on the books up to date as soon as the episode's out. So thanks so much for that.
Yeah, and we have Una McCormick on. She's going to talk about Enigma Tales, and that's the feature. So I'm really excited about that.
So excited about that. Love Una. Spoiler alert, love this book. So really excited to talk to her about that. Not a lot in the news this week. We do have one news item, which was kind of a companion piece to Dayton Ward's new Klingon Empire travel guide. He was soliciting answers on Facebook to the question, you know, what are some common off-world questions that Klingons might be really sick of hearing tourists say to them when they're on Kronos. So Inside Editions, along with Dayton Ward, has put together a little article highlighting the 7 common off-worlder questions that Klingons are tired of hearing. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's a lot of fun to read through that. It's a nice little companion piece, like I say, to the travel guide. Just as an example, some of the questions... Is there anything on your menu that doesn't move? Is one that just Klingons are sick of hearing. And my favorite, of course, is today a good day to die? So if you're visiting the Klingon homeworld or anywhere in the Klingon Empire, just, you know, give those guys a break. Don't ask those questions. Make sure, you know, forewarned is forearmed. Make sure, read this. Know what questions you just probably shouldn't be asking when you're in the Klingon Empire.
I don't know if I want to go visit there because I have to be very careful what I say. I feel like, you know, because if you really tick off a Klingon, things aren't looking good for you. You know, like the one question don't ask is, didn't Klingons used to look more like humans? And I keep thinking of Trials and Tribulations where, you know, Worf is like, you know,
we do not discuss it with outsiders.
Yes, we do not discuss it with outsiders.
So if you don't want to be cleaved in twain by a Batleth, you know, maybe steer clear of these questions for sure. So
yes, and so
fun stuff there.
This did come out on July 11th. So if you haven't picked up your travel guide, do it now before the summer's over.
Yep, absolutely. You'll want to do all that last minute planning for a Klingon Empire trip for sure. Well, that's all that I've got in news, Bruce. So what do you say we meet everyone on the other side of the page and talk to Una McCormick about Enigma Tales? So today we have a very special guest. We're very excited to be talking about the new Deep Space Nine novel, Enigma Tales, by author Una McCormick. And Bruce, we've got Una here to talk with us about it. So,
well, that's
Una,
convenient.
Welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Thank you very much. Hi, it's very, very nice to be here. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, always happy to have you on the show, and especially always happy to have you on to talk about another one of your, if I may say, brilliant Garrick novels. I
definitely say that. Say that as many times as you like.
Excellent.
So what's with you and Garrick? You guys seem to hang out a lot together.
I don't know what happens. He tapped on my skull sometime in 1999, and that was it. I've not been able to shake him off. And of course, he's not the kind of person you can evade very easily. He's sort of wherever you hide, he's going to find you. So I don't know. Something about his voice just spoke to me, and it hasn't let up. And he goes off for a few years at a time, and then he'll sort of waltz back in and go, now what? You know, where were we? Let's pick up again. And you go, oh my God, all right, okay, let's prepare to be terrified again. So, I've no idea. His vocabulary is much better than mine. It's very interesting. He uses words that I go, I didn't know that word, but it's somewhere in the subconscious, and Garrick manages to rummage it out. He's very good at that.
So when you're writing Garrick, words are coming out that you're typing that you don't even know because
occasionally that's happened. I've gone, do I know that word? And then I've kind of looked it up and gone, oh yes, it does mean what Garrick meant. So, not very often, but it's happened every so often. I mean, my vocabulary is not too bad, but his is slightly better, I think. But also he's, you know, well, he's got the aid of a universal translator. So,
Well, we're doing something a little bit different with this episode. We're trying something new. The first half of our discussion, we're going to try and keep it as spoiler-free as possible. And then what we're going to do is kind of have a little bit of a warning for our listeners when we get into the more spoilery bits of this novel. So to start with, why don't you just give us a kind of a quick rundown of what the story is in this novel. Where do we find our characters and what's kind of going on in Enigma Tales without really, you know, spoiling the ending yet? We will get there, but...
I'm going to assume that people have read my previous book, which is The Crimson Shadow, because that's 3 or 4 years old now. But where that ends is with Garrick becoming Castellan of the Cardassian Union, which is basically he's just been elected president. So it's a little bit like Putin becoming, implausibly becoming head of state of Russia or something. This is where we are at the end of the Crimson Shadow. We've got this very dubious character. Garrick has a very dubious past, has always lived in the shadows, becoming head of state. And what I wanted to do in Enigma Tales was pick up a little while after and see just how that was working out for Garrick. He sort of strikes makes a promise to his ghosts in Crimson Shadow that he's not going to kill anyone. He's going to try and live within the checks and balances, live within the law. So this is part of what Enigma Tales does. Enigma Tales, people may or may not remember, are they're a sort of genre of Cardassian literature. They're a kind of crime novel. But this being Cardassia, everybody is guilty. The kind of puzzle is working out how people are guilty. We assume everyone is guilty. So the chief theme of Enigma Tales is the nature of guilt. There's a lot of that sloshing around on Cardassia because of their past and their past on Bajor and their treatment of their own people. So that was partly what I wanted to explore, was we've had a nation or a society that's got a very checkered, very bloodied past, then has a comeuppance. And then I wanted to come back to that nation a little while later and go, well, how's it going for you guys? Have you really sat down and worked on this? We have a historical counterpart here in Europe. Germany obviously has handled its history magnificently. I think, you know, we joke about Angela Merkel being leader of the free world these days, but, you know, there's something true about that. Germany has looked at its past and promised that's never going to happen again, and seriously dealt with that as a culture and a society. And that's the kind of thing I wanted to explore in with Cardassia and in Enigma Tales. So the nature of guilt and who is not guilty in a guilty society, I guess, were the things I wanted to look at through the medium of a Star Trek novel. Why not? So is that? I hope that's sufficiently spoiler free. It's a murder mystery set in a university is the other tagline.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's excellent. Well, in Enigma Tales, we do talk about and deal with a lot of different characters, some of whom we know from Deep Space Nine, of course, Garak being chief among them. Dr. Pulaski, of course, from TNG. We've got her coming back after you kind of brought her back in The Missing, and now we get her back here, which was a lot of fun. I thought you captured her voice very, very well.
Good. Thank you.
And Netima Lang, who I have always thought is a very fascinating character. I love the episode Profit and Loss and her role in that, and I always wanted to know more about her. I was kind of wondering, how did you decide that she would be kind of a central character in this novel?
Well, I'd written a novel previously called The Neverending Sacrifice, in which she features, and that's about Cardassia before it sort of gets burnt down and destroyed. And she was one of the figures that I posited as a sort of, I think we're given this textually in the program, she's a great hope of Cardassian democracy. Now, she's one of these lucky Cardassians who isn't in Cardassia when the Jem'Hadar pretty much kill everyone. So I thought, well, someone like that is going to come back. She's been in exile somewhere. She's going to come back and try to pick up where she was, insofar as you could. But she's one of the really guiltless people. She's striven to, she's been very brave under a totalitarian regime. She's, run an underground railway to get people out into freedom. And I wanted to come back to this person, and part of my central theme and part of what happens in the book is you've got someone that Cardassians look to go, look, here's the living proof that we're not all bastards. And part of what I want to do in this book is say, well, was everybody free of that taint? And she was a very useful figure to do that. So I had someone who was, what's nice with a character like Netima Lang is that you've got her in the show, so you've got a very strong visual image and perhaps a voice that you can take. But apart from that, you've got quite a blank canvas, so you can put a character of your own there, but with enough hooks that the reader can go, I know immediately what this person looks like and who they are. I've never quite got the relationship with Quark to work. I'm not entirely convinced about that, but maybe one day, you know, we all have our we all have our moments, don't we? So at some point, I'll get that relationship with Quark to work. So that was what Lang was. She was a very convenient figure through which I could explore some of the themes of the book, and quite a combination of a few details and a blank slate that I could kind of steal, basically. So yes, she was great to write about.
Well, yeah, this is a murder mystery, but at the same time, you mentioned Quark. You could write a romantic novel now, including Lang and Quark.
Yes. Maybe I could have Pulaski in as the matchmaker or something. That would be. I always feel like Pulaski. I know everyone.
Why do you love Pulaski? There's something about Pulaski. I can tell in your writing you love her. Yes,
she's absolutely hilarious. I remember watching Next Gen, and you know, Crusher's there in the first season. I absolutely adore Crusher as well, and I love Gates McFadden. I've seen her at conventions. She's an amazing woman. But Pulaski came on screen. I just thought she was funny. I thought she was a hoot. She was kind of a bit. She's a bit like I'd be. She's a bit kind of cross about things. She's a bit, she's a bit cutting all the time. She only puts her foot in it. I just think she's great. She's a hoot. You don't often see female characters like that. So Pulaski is sort of, if Garrick is the means by which I indulge my baser instincts, she's the means by which I get to be very badly behaved in public. So that's the pleasure of Pulaski. She can just be a bit rude. And yes, at the same time, she's frank, she's honest, she's courageous, she's smart, she's kindly in many ways. There's lots to like about her, but at the same time, she takes no prisoners and she takes no nonsense. So I just have a whale of a time. I think of her as a lead in a screwball comedy from like the 20s or 30s. So I imagine her in like The Thin Man or something like that. So there's always, is what you were saying about writing a romantic comedy, there's always a little bit of the screwball comedy when I'm writing her, which I try to do with Picard to some extent, because I think they are hilarious. But my character, Peter Alden, I sort of have in that role, the foil for Pulaski's shouting and crossness and rudeness. I think she's great. So, you know, I know a lot of people don't agree.
No, I loved her in this book. I mean, I do like Pulaski, but I do love her in this book because it's like you said, she can be rude and a little much, but she realizes that. And she says, well, you know, that's the package you get. That's who I am. You just, you know, take it for what it is. I know who I am.
If you don't want me to say something stupid on national television, don't put me on national television, I guess. She knows her limitations. She knows what she's good at. I think she's what I've tried to do in this book and the previous book, where I use her. She surrounds herself with good people who will tell her she's going too far, but at the same time admire her courage, her tenacity, her smarts as well. She's very, very clever and works very hard. So I think these are all admirable qualities. I wonder how much I'd enjoy her company. Probably quite a lot. Maybe for just, you know, you go out for dinner once a month or something and have a laugh and then go, oh, thank goodness we don't see her again for another 4 weeks or whatever. But yeah, I think she's great fun. She's one of these grand dames, isn't she? So it's great to write.
And then she has Peter Alden, her colleague, there to help balance things. Like you're saying, he's the more grounded character. Is that why you built him around her? Or
he was an interesting experiment. A while ago, after the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings films came out, I got really sort of sideswiped by them, and I spent far too much time writing Lord of the Rings fan fiction. I don't know if you guys know Lord of the Rings very well, if you know the movies or you know the book. There's a character called Faramir, and I wrote a lot of fan fiction about him, and he's very he's like the virtuous heart, one of the virtuous hearts of Lord of the Rings, him and Sam and a couple of other characters. And I thought it'd be really interesting to take a character like that and put him in a more conflicted setting. So you take him out of a high fantasy setting, which is quite, you know, people's motives can always be pure and their actions can always be pure. Let's stick him in the middle of a science fiction novel, which is much more realist, and say, okay, well, you're quite cerebral, you're quite calculating, you're quite intelligent. You'd probably end up a spy. Spy's hands are always a bit dirty. So let's see how a character like that, who's caught between a quite pure idealism and the reality of the task that he's got to do, and see what happens to him. And in the book I've created him, he kind of cracks. And he cracks so much that he starts doing a PhD with Pulaski, more or less.
Excellent. So a lot of these characters, of course, are from your previous books and previous Star Trek. One character that correct me if I'm wrong, I think she's new to this book, is Emila Antok, the historian and the expert on the Bajoran occupation. And she's, I believe, a quarter Bajoran. Am I correct about that?
Yes, she's Emila Antok is her father's mother is a Bajoran comfort woman, so she's the granddaughter. She's a quarter Bajoran. Mm. Yes, and she's new for this book.
I really I loved that perspective, and it was something that I never really thought of. You know, the kind, you know, we get the story of the comfort women through Deep Space Nine, the Bajoran women that Cardassian soldiers, you know, basically abducted and you know, used with their troops. But I never gave a thought to the offspring of that. And I mean, we got Zial, but beyond that, we never really hear anything of that. And I thought that was a really fascinating aspect of the story to bring in. I was kind of wondering, like, what kind of inspirations did you use when creating that character?
I think that the things that are coming to mind, I think there are two things. I think there's the passing stories that you read about from African-American writers who try to pass as white. And I just read Nella Larson's book, Passing, which is a classic novel about this. I think I'm also thinking about the history of British imperialism in India. And when the British initially arrive, they marry Indian women, the idea is to sort of create a colonial caste in a way, the people that you will have as the masters of the on the ground, who are part indigenous but part British, and then it all gets bound up in extreme racism, and there's no intermarriage, and there's color bars and so forth. But there's still quite a distinct, very small but very distinct Anglo-Indian community in India who are descended from both, the imperialists and women who were there. And I think I was thinking of them. So all of these things are to do, one of the themes of all of my books is to do with imperialism and how that affects everybody. And there are always these little side stories of odd experience, and I'm sort of very caught up in where your loyalties must lie, because you're always going to feel halfway between both. You're going to love your mother and you're going to love your father, but at the same time, one of them will represent a society that's done terrible things to the other's society. And I find those stories very moving, and the difficulty that people must have to come to terms with both parts of their heritage, particularly in a culture that won't allow them to admit or display one part of that. So I wanted her to be a figure that was a promise of a kind of healing for Cardassia, that Cardassia would admit that part of its reality now was Bajoran. It had to admit that. It's now in its DNA, I guess. So she was the figure that I wanted there. And Zial's story we get, obviously, in the show as well. I think Zial is like, what I wanted for Antok was that she could pass as Cardassian, that just on the street you wouldn't go, oh, she's half Bajoran, whereas with the Zial you would, I think, and I wanted that with Antok. So and then I give her this interest in the occupation. She's a historian, so it's a personal and a social history she's exploring, so that I think is where she came from. I think so. It's always very difficult to say where you get things from. You just pull it out of your head and then you go, oh, probably I read something. I think I was watching an episode of Who Do You Think They Are? Do you get this show over there? It's where they take famous people and they track down their genealogy. I just watched one about Charles Dance, which is very moving. He found he had a half-sister he knew nothing about and a whole family he knew nothing about. And I think I'd been watching about the Anglo-Indian community through one of those. So yeah, I just get everything off the telly. That's just consume a lot of television and then try and turn it into stories, I think.
Well, that's really fascinating. The whole theme of this book, or one of the themes of it, is that whole relationship of Cardassia with Bajor. And it really gets you thinking about where these two societies are with each other, that they're pretty much married to each other. And it's not just in the relationship of the two worlds, but there are people now that are both Cardassian and Bajoran in some manner. And it really shows that these two worlds cannot stand apart for a while.
No, they can't. And it's the tragedy is that, of course, it's been an abusive relationship. Bajor is always somehow going to find itself forced back because of these ties of blood that exist, and people who say, well, I'm part you, I'm part you, and don't make me choose. And partly because I think Cardassia makes this decision, at least in my view of Cardassia, makes this decision to genuinely confront what it did in the past. And so it has to. Of course, it's always down to the Bajorans to say thank you and get lost. It's on the part of the people who've suffered, it's always their prerogative to go, thanks very much, this is your problem. I think Bajor, once it enters the Federation, is in a strong enough position that it can, it's recovered enough. I think it's prepared to move on. And people are aging, people are dying. You've got more people who haven't lived under the occupation. It's not even memory for them. So things change, I think, or they can do.
What do you think the younger generation of Cardassia thinks of Bajor?
That's a really interesting question. Intrigued. I wonder whether there had been... So in some of my books, I've sort of had a Federation mission to Cardassia, and I wonder if some Bajorans were there as Federation relief workers. So whether that was an experience of Bajorans looking out for them and looking after them. Younger people, a little ashamed. Maybe some think, well, I had nothing to do with this. I just want to be friends. But then maybe feel rebuffed or hurt when Bajorans quite understandably go, whoa, thank you very much, but no thanks. Really complex, really interesting issue, I think. You'd have to look, I guess, again, I'd look at Germany in the 60s maybe to think about that. How would they relate to somebody French or somebody from a country that they'd occupied or to a Jewish person that they met? So that would be the kind of model I'd look for. Questioning, I hope, and prepared to take a rebuffal, if not blame, I think. Paul, this is heavy going, isn't it? There's a lot of laughs in this book as well. It's quite a funny
book. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, we want to get to the meat of things, and then we'll lighten it up again.
Well, I think this might be a good time to kind of get into the spoilery bits of the book. So warning to everyone listening out there, if you haven't read this book, what's the matter with you? Go grab it and read it, because it's terrific. And we're going to be talking about spoilers in this book now. So Netima Lang is kind of, represents, I think, the best of Cardassia. You know, she was part of the dissident movement and, opposed, didn't really seem to get her hands dirty and wasn't a part of that. But now someone is trying to discredit her and smear her reputation. And this part of the story, basically this project, Project Enigma, that they allege that she had signed off on when she was part of a committee at the university, it took, allegedly took Cardassian Bajoran children and genetically tried to alter them to make them pure Cardassians and reintroduce them into Cardassian society with no knowledge of where they had come from and that sort of thing. And I know you talked about this going to some dark places, but this part of the story really spoke to me. There's a, I'm from Canada and I'm a Métis, and that's part Indigenous, part white colonial, ancestry. And something that happened, and it's known in Canada, is the 60s scoop.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And I just recently was reading a thesis about that brought this up. And what happened was they took children, newborn babies from Aboriginal and Métis mothers in the hospital and put them in the foster system or gave them to white families for adoption, telling, the mothers that their child had died or even just outright telling them, you're unfit to care for this child. We're taking it. And just the resonance in this book for that part of the story was really, really emotional. And I was wondering, what kind of real world examples, was that something that you had studied? I believe your background is sociology. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I think possibly I was thinking about Indigenous Australians who are very, very similar and continues to this day, I suspect, a really, really a cruel history there. So the 60s scoop, it's the 1960s, isn't it? As late as that. Terrible. Possibly, I think maybe my background is my grandparents were from Ireland, and I suspect there were similar experiences as well that kind of Irish children would be taken. I don't think it's as happened as much. But I think I was thinking chiefly of Australia, but it doesn't surprise me to hear similar stories in Canada. I think if I can say that, I'm not sure that Canada has necessarily come to terms with this as much as it could do. Yeah.
I mean, there are things like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and that sort of thing. But, you know, the more I learn, the more I hear about these kinds of things that it just aren't in the mainstream. A lot of people don't know about this sort of thing. And it's very tragic. And it's sad how prevalent this story is from various places around the world, like you said.
All around the world, I think. Yeah, you would Australia, you would probably find it in certainly in Canada, probably in India as well. I think wherever imperialism or kind of white supremacist imperialism has sort of, you know, had its hand, you're going to find a story like this. I find these questions of identity they're just very heart-wrenching. Like, you know, telling mothers their kids are dead, honestly, what motivates people? It's just it's crackers, isn't it? What's happening is that comes out of your mouth and you're thinking this is a good thing. I think what science fiction lets me do is distance myself from, you know, if I thought too long about the real stories, it would cut me up too much. I'd be too angry. I'd be too upset. And science fiction, I think, allows you to just step one step back and write passionately, but not in a way that will damage you or will upset you to the extent that you can't write persuasively. I think if you are too angry or there's too a message in your writing, your reader turns off. So a lot have a sleight of hand and talk about these things in a way that people don't feel like they're being lectured to, but you still steep your message in. So I think that's what was happening there. I thought we were getting onto the cheerful bits.
we'll definitely get there for sure.
It really is a really funny book. I really want to.
Well, absolutely. Expand on that when you say it's a funny book. How would you describe this book real briefly to someone if they said, what kind of book is it? You said it was a murder mystery, but what makes it fun? What makes it a funny book to you?
I think Pulaski makes it funny and her screwball romance with Alden, which is going to end. Who knows where that's going to end. I think Garrick's exasperation you should find very enjoyable as well. There's a man kind of going, just let me loose on these people, and other people going, well, now you remember, Garrick, you're not allowed to kill anyone anymore. So there's a lot of kind of humor in his situation, his frustration with Pulaski as well. So I'd like to think that on a line by line level there was quite a lot of fun in the book. But at the same time, I can't stop myself. It's going to be dealing with some of these things that are always praying at the back of my mind. But I'm hoping that people enjoy the conversations and enjoy the characters rubbing up against each other and annoying each other. And Pulaski's always good fun. I think she moves like a force of nature. And I hope that's what it feels like in the book, that there's just somebody coming through wisecracking and being a little bit rude, and that's funny, so I hope.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. I actually liked it when she was kidnapped and when she realizes that, you know, she's locked up somewhere, she's like, really? Ugh, like, I'm having such a bad day, you know, I'll just have to deal with it and move on, you know. And then she gets out.
We're in the kidnap routine. Yeah,
right. It just comes with Starfleet, you know.
Yeah, so she's great value. And yeah, I think it's. I certainly enjoyed writing it. I had really good fun writing this book, and I think hopefully that communicates. I think if you're in a good mood when you write a book, some of that good mood will communicate itself. I think it's probably a gag on every other page. So it is fun, folks.
it definitely shows that absolutely does come true. Come through in this book. I love in particular just one thing that leapt on the page off the page at me was anytime they had mentioned Jean-Luc Picard and his thoughts on Pulaski. Oh, that woman,
that bloody woman, that bloody bloody woman. And it's Garrick finds himself saying the same thing as well. So he just tears Jean-Luc in the background. He's driven to exasperation, I'm sure that she, in the back of my mind, I am sure that she intended to make Picard a Mr. Pulaski, but he managed to get away. But I always have that in the back of my mind, what that marriage would have been like. So, yeah, it's great fun. I hope her, I give her a little sidekick as well. Not Alden, but I give her a kind of Cardassian who's looking after her, who's quite naive. He's quite young. He's had a tough upbringing, like all Cardassians, but he's quite, you know, he's quite a quiet and gentle type. And he finds himself just whirled along in this madness. And he loves it. He has the ride of his life. You know, he thinks it's a complete riot. So, you know, you've got a kid that's just come off a roller coaster again. So he has a great time. I think he grows up a little bit. And she gives him a really good racing tip, and he makes a lot of money on it. So I don't know if you've ever done a lot of long haul traveling, and you get off a long haul flight. So the first thing you want to do is just sit in the hotel and watch episodes of Law and Order for about 9 hours until your jet lag goes. And I thought, well, this is what Pulaski will do. She's just got off a long flight. She'll sit there. She'll find like the History Channel, and then she'll get a bit bored because, you know, that's a bit depressing. So she'll just turn on the racing. And that seemed very Pulaski to me. And within about, you know, three or four sessions, she'll be one of the, you know, she'll be an expert. She would sort of sit after about 3 hours. She's so smart that she would be one of the experts, you know. She'd work out who the hot tips were and this kind of thing. So I thought that's exactly what she would do. And then sticking her in front of a live mic is always going to be good. So
I love how she's telling Cardassians like who to bet on, who's more likely to win. That she just picks this up within just like a couple days.
So one thing I do have to say about the topic of this being a fun novel, I made a note of this. Anytime you have a Cardassian character talking to a Vulcan ambassador and quoting The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I was just about rolling on the floor about that when he makes his remark about the tea being mostly harmless.
Only slightly harmless. It just pops out. I have this feeling that once the Federation arrive on Deep Space Nine, Garak has got many, many lonely hours to fill. And all he does is read human literature. And he kind of starts with Beowulf and ends up at, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I think he's probably better read than most people. And of course he would read Douglas Adams. Douglas Adams is going to be a future classic, already is. Some of my students have not heard of him, which I find heartbreaking. I know, I can't tragic. Bear it. Yeah, and they're living in Cambridge as well. It absolutely breaks my heart. So I make them read him. I don't know how much they enjoy it, but they tell me they do. But then I'm out their essays. These things just pop out, I think. But Garrett would definitely have read it.
Yeah, anytime I hear of a friend who's never read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I lend them my copy.
So. Exactly. Right on to them. Do they enjoy it? Do they tend to enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. If they don't, they're not my friends anymore. So
that's it. That's right. It was great, but goodbye. Quite right.
So long, and thanks for all the fish, as it were.
Mostly harmless. Yeah. So that's what Garak thinks. So I think there's some fun in Garak knowing human literature and quoting it back at you as well.
Yeah, there is fun in Garak. And, you know, we were talking about Pulaski and her relationships with certain characters. Mm-hmm. What about Garak's relationship with, like, Parmak and, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing these right, like, Mevet? Is that right?
Mevet. She's interesting. She's a sort of quasi-daughter, I think. He's quite paternal towards her. And I think that's partly to do with, obviously, he doesn't have a great father-son relationship with his own father. And I think once he comes to terms with that, it's too late for Garak to have, not really practical for Garak to have children of his own, but he's sort of almost adopts an adult daughter who he's got a professional relationship with, but he's part mentor and part paternal towards her because he's become invested in the next generation and he's become invested in what kind of people they are. He wants them to be good people. And that's why he gets invested in her, I think. She's quite smart. She's not afraid of him. Well, she is. She's terrified of him, actually, on some level. Everybody's terrified of Garak on some level. But she's not afraid to confront that fear and tell him when she thinks he's going too far. And that's very important for Garak. So it works both ways, I think.
Do you think... I don't know if Garrick's the right person right now to lead Cardassia. I think he's done what he needs to do, but I think there's the matter of trust, and he's got a past. And
yeah.
Is that kind of why we're setting up Lang to possibly succeed him?
That's certainly in Garrick's mind. I think he knows that. I don't think he saw himself as more than a one-term Castellan. Maybe two, if there were some things he felt, if things had moved too slowly, and he could, he'd hate to lose an election, so he wouldn't run for an election that he thought he would lose. But I think he felt he'd come in with a very specific job to do, which was to make sure that the experiment in democracy didn't derail or fall back into totalitarianism, authoritarianism. And I think he's feeling that that's achieved, or very close to being achieved now. I think he's still got issues of his own personal guilt to think through, his own actions. He's never really been held accountable for anything. Sisko bangs him up for 6 months for attempted genocide, which I think is one of the more interesting prison sentences I've ever seen. But so he's only ever been 6 months in jail, and he's done some bad stuff. So I think he feels there's a round of personal atonement. What that will involve, I don't know.
I love that Garrick himself kind of comments on that. Like, he kind of pauses and goes, yeah, 6 months. Oh, okay.
Now, I might have given me, I don't know, life. So, yeah, exactly. So I think that's one of those things where perhaps the, I don't know, maybe the writers hadn't quite thought through what Garrick was doing, which is an attempt, you know, it is genocide. It's attempting, tries to wipe out a species, doesn't he? It's not a nice thing to do. Probably give him. I think what he gets punished for is damage to a Federation spaceship, which you might give, you know, criminal damage, and not xenocide. So I always thought that was a bit of an odd sentence. But I suspect there's a lot of things in Garrick's past that we still don't know about, maybe he feels he needs to be punished for those.
Well, I love that, how that kind of feeds into, you know, the structure of the novel itself. You know, we talk about Cardassian Enigma Tales, where the goal isn't to find out who is the guilty party, but to know that everybody's guilty of something, but, you know, what are they all guilty of? And I feel like that's, I mean, very obviously set up as a mirror to Cardassian society right now. You know, everybody has some sort of guilt about the past, and, you know, everybody, including Garrick, very obviously, and, you know, most of the characters we deal with all have this kind of guilt lingering in their backgrounds. And it's kind of a neat meta examination through the literary form and then in the quote unquote real world of the novel itself.
And I think what I'm hinting at, or what I hope I'm hinting at too, is that as time passes, there are more Cardassians being born who don't have that guilt. So they can sort of start to let go of Enigma Tales in a way. They can start to tell different stories about themselves. So I'm hoping, I would like to see that happen to Cardassia. So that's sort of where it's going with that. So there might be the big shock would be an Enigma Tale with lots of people who are innocent in it. I think we're not quite sure about Lang's guilt at the end of, I think we think it's a sin of omission at worst. But bureaucracies are funny like that. You sort of, people cannot specifically do bad things, but bad things happen because of omission or a failure to act. So I think even Lang, maybe there's just a touch of a taint about her. But much better than Garrick. Yeah.
Absolutely. I have to say, I really love how you set up the fact that Garrick is kind of pushing for her to become the next Castellan. And it's one of those things that, like, when I was reading and I realized, and it was the chapter before it's outright stated, but then it's actually the line where they're at the memorial, and this is when it just exploded in my mind, when the novel says, later that image would come back to Pulaski again and again, the men dressed in black walking away into darkness, the woman in white moving forward to greet the people gathered. I was just like, of course. And then thinking back, there's like, you know, 50,000 hints all through it. And the payoff there is just absolutely brilliant. I loved that.
Tell you how much that makes my little writer heart sing, because I'm sitting there writing this going, please let somebody get this. I'm so proud of this sentence. It's so beautiful. I mean, I'm sitting here going, I'm the god of prose. And to have that reflected back that it's done exactly. And the hints as well, that's particularly gratifying. I think what you're always doing as a writer is you want it to not come at completely left field. So you have to be working this stuff in, but not in such a way that on page three, they're going, oh, she's going to be Castellan, isn't she? So really, I'm sitting here like I'm sort of preening, like a cat licking its whiskers at this point. Yeah. So, and I loved that image. I was very proud of that. It moved me quite a bit writing that, because I felt it was a sort of, the darkness is passing for Cardassia. There are better times coming and genuinely good times and happy mm-hmm. times and guilt-free times. So I'm thrilled that you've picked that bit out. Very, very thrilled. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, like, it's just, it's a beautiful image. And I had to stick a bookmark in there and mark exactly where that was, because I was like, oh, yes, I think I figured it out.
Oh, yes, and you had.
Yeah. Sure enough, next chapter, I'm like, yes.
Yes, I'm in there. And that's the other thing you want to do as a novelist. I want you at some point to go, yes, I have got this, before she tells me. So I want you to feel good about reading the book, that you've got my hints and that you've been rewarded. You can go, yes, I am a smart reader. So, and indeed you were. So you should feel good about reading the book. Yeah.
Just so people
we
know.
Very hard.
He's patting his back, literally.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm licking my whiskers and he's patting his back.
Right before we started recording, before Una joined us, he was talking to me about, you know, oh, I love this part, and I had to bookmark it. So we got to that. So, you know, and I like the idea that, you know, there's little hints throughout, and maybe we haven't always picked up on those hints, but that's what makes it fun to go back and reread, because once you know what's going to happen, then you pick up on those and like, oh, why didn't I see that before or whatever. You know, that's, I always enjoy that when it comes to
reading. I hope it stands up to rereading. I really hope it does. I hope there's fun in it.
We're going to have to try to do that. We're going to have to try to reread it and see. So one of the things I want to touch on, you know, you can't think of Garrick without Bashir. And Bashir is kind of woven a little bit throughout the book here and there, but there isn't a whole lot for him to do, because now we're spoilers on this book, but this is also spoilers on Section 31 Control. So if anybody hasn't read that book, maybe you want to stop now listening to this.
Yeah, and you want to read that book before you read this book, I think. Mm-hmm. And read it anyway, because it's brilliant.
That's a good point. Yeah. So talk to us about working Bashir in this book, because you didn't have a lot to deal with the character, but you had a lot to deal with the relationship between the two.
Yeah, this was really interesting, because I pitched a completely different book. I pitched a book where Bashir is fine and he comes to Cardassia and he's almost in the Pulaski role here. And then I got an email back from Margaret Clark saying, I'm really sorry, you've been macked. David Mack's proposal for Control was just a few weeks ahead of mine in the pile. So I had to go off and kind of go, all right, okay, well, that's that buggers my book. Okay, all right, let's sort of think of what else I can do. So I had to sort of turn it round, and David was just brilliant. He sort of let me read Control very, very early on. And sent me relevant bits. And I thought, okay, well, actually, I think I can get a much more emotional story out of this, that Bashir's absence gives Garrick the chance to grieve him. And I think Bashir has been a very important figure in Garrick's life, because he's the start of Garrick sort of going, Bashir's just so good in a way, you know, it's sort of uncomplicatedly a man of honour. This affects Garrick. And so to have to grieve his absence and find new sources to give Garrick that inspiration, that strength, was quite a compelling story for me, I think. I think it makes Garrick... I liked the idea of putting Garrick in the role of having to be a healer in some way in return, that it's now a gift that he has to dig into himself and find a way to find the strength and the courage and the resources to spend time with Bashir, who, if people have read Control, they know he's in a catatonic state, and has to find the resources to bring him back out. And Garrick has to dig quite deep for that. I think it'd be much easier for him to ignore it, sort of be flippant about it, sort of push it away. But he has to come back and try and bring Bashir back, I think, or somebody has to do it, and Garrick's on the spot. So I, in a way, ended up sort of losing my outline, sort of made me dig a bit deeper. And also I got to bring Pulaski in that part and had a lot of fun with her. So so yeah, that's sort of where that came from. I got macked.
You're not the first.
No, I won't be the last, I don't think.
That was, I mean, a very beautiful part of the story. And that final scene with them together. I mean, they just have such a touching, beautiful relationship. And yeah, the little tiny bit of payoff we get with just the barest little response from Bashir. It's one of those things where you're...
Scarrick's not looking. He's got his nose in the book. I know, can I?
And it's one of those things, you're reading the book and I'm reading it. And I'm like, okay, I know that they won't resolve the Bashir thing in this novel because that's not what this novel's about. But that just that even that little hint of a payoff at the end was like I was very moved by that. And oh Bashir, come back to us.
Please. It was Dave Mack's idea to he sort of pinged me an email and said, oh, I'd forgotten about Kukulaka and maybe you can work Kukulaka in. So that was Dave's idea, and that was an absolute gift. That was brilliant. I think it was perfect. And I think that's really moving, that the sort of touch or the feel or the smell of your childhood toy would be the kind of thing that would begin to sort of trigger memory. And poor old Kukulaka, he's gone through the wars, hasn't he? So I think it's going to be a long journey, and it's going to take patience on everyone's part to bring Bashir back, I think.
Well, I think I speak for both of us when I say very impressed with this novel. I think it's
absolutely
much like... Yeah, The Crimson Shadow, when it came out, for example, was my absolute favorite Star Trek novel that year, and this one is right up there on par with it.
We had no doubts. We had no doubts going into this.
No.
We knew we were going to love this.
Oh, I had a lot of doubts. I've had a very busy time since I wrote Crimson Shadow. I've had a baby and been very busy, and, you know, you have a small child. It consumes your energies. And so I was a bit scared going back to Cardassia and whether I'd managed to find some of the magic. But I think I'm pleased with a lot of what I did in this book. I think it came together, and I'm satisfied with it. And it's really nice to get bits of it quoted back and, you know, to hear that it's worked for people. So thank you.
So is there anything coming up Star Trek-wise or otherwise that you think our listeners should be made aware of?
There's nothing Star Trek coming up yet. I hope there will be something, because I feel like there's another book. Those of you who've read to the end of the book probably feel there's another book after this one, which is sort of forming in my head, but nothing concrete yet. I think the only thing I can talk about is I have a novella coming out from Tor.com next year. And I'm very excited about this because I'm working again with Marco Palmieri, who people might remember was the editor of the Star Trek book range, and indeed the man who gave me my first professional commission. So I'm working with Marco again on our sort of tagline for it is high plane, feminist high planes drifter in space. So there you go. That's high concept, isn't it? So if you know
that
the Clint
really
Eastwood,
cool.
I hope so. I hope I haven't mispitched it. So that's written, that's with Marco. And I'm waiting to hear back from him whether he likes it or not, which I hope he does. And then I'll either touch it up or rewrite it completely. And that should be out next year. But I think that's the only thing. I've got some other things I'm working on, but I don't think they've been announced, but they will be soon. So, I for those of the listeners who like Doctor Who, I've just got some stuff out with Big Finish. So that came out. I've had a busy couple of months, lots of stuff coming out. That's always nice. You work on something and then you don't think about it for months. I think I finished this book in November or something. No, it must have been earlier than that. I can't remember now. And then everything comes out, and it's very exciting. So there's some Doctor Who stuff out. There's a novella coming, and fingers crossed, eventually more Star Trek, because I do enjoy it.
Excellent. Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear we love it too. So, you know, if we could get another Cardassian epic story from you, we would be lining up to pick that
and,
up.
And of
sure.
course, there's the whole Lang Quark romantic comedy novel.
Indeed, yes, which I've practically promised now, haven't
That's
I? Get a Shakespearean comedy of errors with Quark, Lang, Pulaski, and Alden. So you heard it here first.
That sounds exciting. I look forward to many Sumerian sunsets thrown in Quark's face.
Pretty much the book, isn't it?
Excellent. Well, where can our listeners find you online if they want to keep up to date with what's going on with your writing world?
Absolutely on Twitter, where I'm just at Una McCormack. So I think I don't have time to keep a blog or a website updated these days. So that's definitely the place to find me. I'm usually complaining about what I'm watching on the television. So if that sounds interesting, that's what I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us about Enigma Tales. And we really look forward to having you on again with the next, whether it's a romantic comedy with Quark or what have you.
It'd be really good fun to do that. And thanks for reading the book and thanks for saying lovely things about it. It really makes my day. So very grateful. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Una.
Oh, thank you for the book.
Well, Dan, I must say that I had a jolly good time talking to Una about this book, and it really is one of two things. Well, no, it's two of things, two things. It's a variety of different things. It's a fun, funny book, and it's also a serious dramatic book in a murder mystery all rolled into one. It's like, I don't know, it's like Skittles. There's like all kinds of flavors, but they're all come in one package.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that she brought up in the interview that really resonated with me was this idea of, you know, having a story be about these really dark, really horrible things, but because it's science fiction, you're able to more freely talk about it and approach the subject with maybe a little bit more openness than you would otherwise. And to me, I was thinking that's the grand tradition of Star Trek, right? I mean, you know, the best Star Trek episodes are the ones that talk about contemporary issues and things that our society is facing, but in the guise of science fiction. So, you know, you can maybe talk about things like the Vietnam War while it's going on, where other shows can't, because it's this science fiction world and it's not real, and you can really talk about these issues. So, you know, just really carrying on the grand tradition of Star Trek. Well, it's been fun talking about Pulaski's shenanigans today, but it's not the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things that you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
After the captain's documentary, I think we all wish that there had been a piano in Sisko's quarters. And at some point in every episode, someone walked in and he was just over in the corner rambling away.
Warp 5.
And there's a wipe from right to left in the screen. And you never see that on Star Trek. It completely pulls me out of the episode every time I see it.
Thanks a lot. Because I've never noticed it before.
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
Ever!
Now I'm going to see it. Okay.
You just ruined the entire episode for everyone listening.
I'm so sorry.
The 602 Club.
That's a really smart idea because that's also something that, you know, Caesar sees is that we're not that different.
The Ready Room.
As with so many places, CBS, in marketing the show and getting it out to as many eyeballs as possible, they're obviously wanting fans and armchair fans and maybe would-be fans, genre fans who might give Star Trek a but they're still trying to get out to the great unwashed and the mundanes. And this is actually stretching the season out beyond 15 actual weeks.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. And if you're not an Apple user, that's okay. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. That's a lot to say. In most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all of the details. Perks can include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. As I'm sure you can imagine, it requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways you can do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will come right to us, and you can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM.
Unique for Literary Treks is our Goodreads group, where we have all the bookshelves with our previously covered books, as well as what we're currently reading, so that you know what is coming up for future shows. And also, there are great conversations happening about the books and comics. Just go to goodreads.com and search for Literary Treks, click Join Group, and we'll let you right in. We'd also like to thank our associate producers, Ken Tripp, Greg Rozier, and Brandon Shemutala, for their support of the Trek FM network, and specifically for being associate producers for Literary Treks. Now, Bruce, when you're not attending an art gallery exhibition of Bajoran and Cardassian art in East Tor, where can we find you?
Oh, I love the art. It's fantastico. But you can also follow me on Twitter at Admiral_Rex. You can hear me talking Star Wars on the Star Wars Report podcast, which is at starwarsreport.com. And of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference. And Dan, when you're not feeling all romantic, reading a romance novel between Lang and Quark, where can people find you?
There's so many drinks getting thrown in Quark's face. And, you know, I'm kind of loving this. But when I'm not reading that, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats, that's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. You can find me on youtube.com/Kertrats Productions, talking about all aspects of the Star Trek universe, including episodes, books, and the latest news from Star Trek Discovery. You can find me on Facebook, tooling around the Babel Conference, talking about Star Trek as usual, and on facebook.com/Kertrats Productions. Well, thank you all so much for listening. And until next time,
live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.